85. Prince Kurbsky. The capacity for heroic deeds, for actions that make extreme demands on a person's strength, depends to a greater or lesser extent on willpower. Some people are born heroes, others are not. The heroic acts that cost the greatest effort are those performed spontaneously by sheer willpower. Such actions are easier if they are the culmination of years of purposeful effort. And for the man born a hero, great deeds are blessedly easy as breathing. Ruska Doronin, for instance, had lived as an outlaw, a wanted man, sought all over the Soviet Union, with the carefree smile of an innocent child. The thrill of risk, the fever of adventure, must have been injected into his bloodstream at birth. Respectable Innocenti, fortunate Innocenti, could never have brought himself to vanish and flit around the country under a false name. Arrest might be imminent, but it would never enter his head that he could do anything to prevent it. He had made his telephone call to the embassy on impulse, without stopping to think. His discovery had come as a surprise, and too late for him to wait those few days until he arrived in New York. He had called like a man possessed, although he knew that all telephones were bugged, and that he was one of the very few people in the ministry who knew Georgi Koval's secret. He had simply flung himself into the abyss because the thought that they could brazenly steal the bomb and in a year's time start brandishing it was intolerable. But he had not been prepared for the shattering impact of the stony bottom. He had cherished a wild hope that he could flutter out of it, escape responsibility, fly across the ocean, get his breath back, and tell his story to the press. But even before he reached the bottom, he had relapsed into impotent despair, spiritual exhaustion. His short-lived resolve had snapped, and terror was consuming him like a flame. He had felt it most acutely that Monday morning, when he had to force himself to begin living again, to go to work, anxiously trying to detect menacing changes in the looks and voices of those around him. Still outwardly self-possessed, Innocenti was internally a wreck, incapable of fighting back, of seeking a way out, of trying to escape. It was not quite 11 a.m. when his boss's secretary, denying him access, informed Innocenti that his appointment, so she had heard, had been held up by the vice minister. This news, though not definite, came as such a shock that Innocenti did not insist on being seen and seeking confirmation. But nothing else could explain the delay, once his departure had been approved. The document accrediting him to the United Nations already bore Vyshinsky's stamp. He had obviously been found out. The world seemed to have become a darker place. His shoulders felt as if he were carrying a yoke with two full pails. Back in his room, it was as much as he could do to lock the door and remove the key so that they would think he had left. He could do this only because the usual occupant of the other desk had not returned from an official trip. Innocenti's insides had turned into a nauseous jelly. He waited for the knock. He was terror-stricken. Any minute now they would come and arrest him. A fleeting thought. Don't open the door. Make them break it down. Or hang yourself before they come in. Or jump out of the window. From the third floor, right into the street. 2 seconds in flight, and smash! Consciousness extinguished. A thick stack of papers lay on the desk, the auditor's estimate of Innocenti's debts. He had to check the account and return it before leaving for abroad. But even the sight of it made him feel sick. The heating was on, but he felt cold, shivery. His feebleness disgusted him. He was passively awaiting his doom. Innocenti lay flat, face down, on the sofa. With the whole length of his body pressed against the sofa, he got from it some support, a kind of reassurance. His thoughts grew confused. Was it really him? Could he really have had the nerve to telephone the embassy? And if so, why? At the other end, someone speaking Russian with an accent. Call the Canadians. Just who are you? How do I know you're telling the truth? Those arrogant Americans. They'll live to see their farmers collectivized to a man, Serve them right. Should never have called. Sorry for myself. Ending my life at 30. Perhaps under torture. But no, he didn't regret calling. It had to be done. It was as though someone had been leading him, and he had felt no fear. No, it wasn't that he had no regrets. He no longer had the will to regret or not to regret. As his sense of imminent danger faded, he lay still, hardly breathing, hugging the sofa, wishing only that it would all end, that they would soon take him away or something. But luckily no one knocked. No one tried the door, and the telephone did not ring once. He lost consciousness. Oppressive dreams, absurd dreams, pursued one another until his head was bursting and he awoke. Unrefreshed, indeed more fatigued, feebler than before he had fallen asleep, exhausted by all the arrests or attempted arrests he had undergone in his dreams. He was too weak to rise from the sofa and shake off his nightmares, or indeed to stir at all. Too weak to resist the sickening drowsiness sucking him back into sleep. He slept again at last, dead to the world. Slept with his mouth open, drooling onto the sofa. The damp patch and the mid-morning bustle in the hallway woke him up. He rose, unlocked the door, and went for a wash. They were bringing tea and sandwiches around. No one was about to arrest him. The colleagues he met in the hallway and the main office behaved toward him as they always did. This proved nothing. How could anyone else know? But their unchanged looks and voices raised his spirits. He asked the girl to bring him really hot, really strong tea, and drank two glasses of it with enjoyment. He felt his confidence growing. But he could still not bring himself to insist on seeing the chief, to try to find out. The sensible solution was obviously to do away with himself. He would simply be obeying his instinct of self-preservation, sparing himself suffering. But only if he knew for sure that they were going to arrest him. Perhaps they weren't. The telephone rang. Innocenti jumped. His heart stood still, then began beating quite audibly. It was only Dotty. Dotty's marvellously musical telephone voice. Dotty talking like a wife reinstated in her conjugal rights. She asked how things were, and suggested going out somewhere that evening. Once again, Innocenti felt a glow of gratitude and affection. Bad wife or not, she was closer to him than anyone. He did not tell her that his posting might have been cancelled. Instead, he imagined himself in a theatre that evening, perfectly safe. People weren't arrested in the theatre in full view of the audience. "All right, get tickets for something cheerful," he said. "The operetta, maybe? It's something called Akulina. There's nothing much on otherwise. It's the Law of Lycurgus at the Little Red Army Theatre and Voice of America at the big one. The arts is doing the unforgettable." Law of Lycurgus sounds too good to be true. The worst plays always get great titles. Book for Akulina, and we'll take in a restaurant after.
Okay, okay.
Dotty laughed happily into the telephone. And stay there all night so they won't find me at home. They always came in the night, of course. Innocenti was gradually recovering his self-possession. What if he was suspected? Shevronik and Zavarzin were more familiar with the details than he was. They must surely be the prime suspects. And anyway, suspicion was one thing, proof another. Suppose I am in danger of arrest. There's nothing I can do about it. Should I be hiding things? There's nothing to hide. So why worry? By now, he felt strong enough to pace the floor as he thought it over. Suppose they are going to arrest me. It may not be today or even this week. So should I stop living? Or should I spend my last few days enjoying myself like crazy? Why had he panicked like that? Only last night, damn it, he had, oh so wittily, defended Epicurus. Why not follow his advice? His ideas seemed sensible enough. Thinking that he ought to look through his notebooks for entries best suppressed, he remembered that he had once jotted down excerpts from Epicurus. He found the place. Our private feelings of satisfaction and dissatisfaction are the ultimate criteria of good and evil, he read. That meant nothing to Innocenti in his present state of mind. He read on. Know that there is no such thing as immortality. Therefore, death is not an evil. It is simply irrelevant to us. As long as we exist, there is no death, and when death comes upon us, we do not exist. Well said. Innocenti leaned back in his chair. Who was it I recently heard saying just that? Yes, of course, that young war veteran at the party last night. Innocenti pictured to himself the garden in Athens. Epicurus, a swarthy septuagenarian in a tunic, was holding forth from marble steps while he, Innocenti, in modern dress, perched on a pedestal, in a casual sort of American pose, listened. Belief in immortality was born of the greed of insatiable people who squander the time that nature has allotted us. But the wise man will find that time sufficient to make the round of attainable delights, and, when the time to die arrives, leave the table of life replete, making way for other guests. For the wise man, one human span suffices, while the foolish man would not know what to do even with eternity. Brilliant! But here's the rub. What if you are dragged from the table not by nature in your 70s, but at 30, by the Ministry of State Security? One should not fear physical suffering. He who knows the limits of suffering is proof against fear. Prolonged suffering is always insignificant, while acute suffering is never for long. The wise man will not lose his spiritual calm even under torture. His memory will bring back to him his former sensual and spiritual gratifications, and, in spite of his present bodily suffering, will restore his spiritual equilibrium. Innocenti began gloomily pacing the office floor. That was what he dreaded, not actually dying, but being arrested and physically tortured. Epicurus says you can rise above torture, does he? If only I had such strength of character. Innocenti knew only too well that he did not. He would die without regret if he knew that people would someday learn that there had been such a citizen of the world and that he had tried to save them from nuclear war. If the communists got the atom bomb, the planet was doomed. But they would shoot him like a dog in the dungeon and hide his case file where it could never be found. He threw back his head as a bird does to let water trickle down its taut throat. But no, the idea that they might tell the world about him was more painful still. We are so befogged, he thought, that we cannot distinguish traitors from friends. What was Prince Kurbsky? A traitor. And what was Ivan the Terrible? The beloved father of his people. But that Kurbsky had escaped his terrible ruler. Innocenti had not been so lucky. If he was exposed, his fellow countrymen would enthusiastically stone him. How many would understand him? 1,000 out of 200 million, if he was lucky. How many remembered the rejection of the sensible Baruch plan? Deny yourselves the atom bomb, and the American bombs will be put under international lock and key. Above all, how did he have the audacity to decide what his country should do when that right belonged to the supreme power alone? You prevented the transformer of the world, the forger of happiness, from stealing the bomb. That means you denied the bomb to your motherland. But what did the motherland want with it? What did the village of Rajdestvo want with it? That half-blind female dwarf? The old woman with the dead chicken, the one-legged peasant in rags and tatters. Who, of all the people in the village, would condemn him for that telephone call? Individually, none of them would even understand the problem. But should they be herded into a village meeting, they would vote unanimously to condemn him. They were short of roads, textiles, planks, glass. Give them back their milk, their bread, maybe even their church bells. But what good was the atom bomb to them? What vexed Innocenti most was that his telephone call might not have prevented the theft after all. The filigreed hands of the bronze clock pointed to 4:45. It was getting dark.